This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. You can subscribe to the app on Apple and Android. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
Lucy Porter is me. I am here for the next 2 hours. And we're going to start off with a track from our record of the week. And I just go straight into it, but I want to kind of give a slight parental advisory, because we, Amanda the producer and I, in the weeks that we've been doing this show, we have remarked that we haven't been really using FUBAR's capacity for you to say anything you want and be uncensored, and we haven't really been making the most of that. And then as I was thinking about what my record of the week would be this week, I was thinking, oh, the Carpenters, that'd be nice, I like the Carpenters. And then another record popped into my head, and this is the record, and it's very much not the Carpenters. Have a listen to it. It's very much not.
Suck and let go.
Suck and let go. Now, that's actually one of the milder tracks on my album of the week, which is The Teachers of Peaches by Peaches. So we'll talk more about it when we get to one of the fruitier, if you'll pardon the pun, Peaches is fruitier. When we get to one of those, we'll have a chat about that later. So my studio guest is, now, for those of you who've never listened to this before, I should set this up. My name is Lucy Porter. Hello. And I do a show which is, we have female guests, we play records by women. We talk about women we love. That's the thing. In fact, someone described it on Twitter this week. There's a lovely man who has been tweeting furiously about our show, and I'm going to find him and tell you all about him. Because Chris, it's still me, is his Twitter name. And he has described this show as woman's hours alter ego, maybe. And he also did a very nice thing, which was he sent me to what he describes as our Lou Radio chat, which this came from a list that we made a few weeks ago, which was a list of things that are unequivocally better about being a woman. And one of them, in fact, the main one really, was that toilets are better. You have to queue for them for longer, but once you get into them, you don't find the horrors that lurk in the male public toilet. So lovely Chris It's Still Me has sent me a beautiful picture that if you go on Twitter and look for me at Luna Bimberton, LoonaBimberton, or Chris It's Still Me, either of us, you'll be able to find this beautiful picture of a garden centre's toilets. And it's not often that you look at a urinal and think, wow, God, that is gorgeous. But this is, it's a collection of four urinals, two of which are shaped like exotic orchids. And it is beautiful, because I did say on the show where we talked about men's public toilets at some length that the Philharmonic Pub in Liverpool, if you are ever in the area and you get the chance to go to the men's toilets at the Philharmonic Pub in Liverpool, spoil yourself. It really is worth a visit. But that was the only one I'd ever seen that I felt made me envy male toilets. So there we go. That was a nice little contribution that we had. We will be having a list this week. I cannot set it up yet because my guest, Viv Groskop, is delayed, and it's dependent on her, really. So I'm going to be talking to the wonderful Viv Groskop. She's going to be my studio guest. And there's lots of things that she's inspired me to think about this week, one of which is the great woman that I have chosen to talk about this week. And when I tell this great woman's life story, I'm going to cry. So just look forward to that. And then in the second hour, of course, we'll be having Pim's. It'll be Pim's time. So now let's have a talk about what's been going on in the news. Tampon tax. People say that female comedians only talk about periods. I'm going to tackle that head on by only talking about periods for the next minute or so. There was a tampon tax. Every now and then it just pops up, doesn't it? I remember when I was younger, it was always lobbying to get the VAT taken off tampons. And then Dawn Primorolo, the Labour MP, she launched a campaign to do just that. And Gordon Brown reduced the VAT on tampons to 5%. And it was a great victory. And I remember at the time everyone saying how they couldn't think of anyone less likely to want to talk about ladies' intimate issues than Gordon Brown, and just how uncomfortable he looked for the whole time of having to talk about tampons. But there's been a story in Australia where an online petition asking the government to stop the Australian government to stop taxing a bodily function attracted about 90,000 signatures, and the Treasurer Joe Hockey. They're so sporty in Australia, they all have sports names. Joe Hockey, who is the Treasurer, of course, their Prime Minister is Stephen Football. Billy Tennis, something else. Anyway, so they made the point that unlike products such as condoms and sunscreen, pads and tampons attract the 10% goods and services tax, the GST, and the Treasurer said that he would address it, and he would advise all the territory, state and territory governments to take away luxury tax on tampons. So this was then hailed as a victory momentarily until the Prime Minister John Howard said, no, actually, that's not going to happen. So it's a non-story. Essentially, something was going to happen, it didn't happen, but it keeps sort of rearing its head over here as well. And now, it taught me a word, this whole debate taught me a word, which was, and I've lost the piece of paper, it was on furphy. So I'm actually not going to really talk about it. I mean, I do think it would be nice if there were no tax on sanitary products, but I can't get that excited about it, Amanda. I'm going to be honest. I mean, it would be better if why don't the companies just make them cheaper? They can't cost that much.
Yeah. And also, it
depends. Oh, am I on? There we go. I'm on now.
This is Amanda, everyone.
Hi. Hello. I'm going to talk about periods.
Yeah.
It does irk me every month. I'm sorry that I have to spend a certain amount of money on something. Yes. I mean, what am I supposed
Maybe
to
I'm
gather
too
moss?
Rich to worry. Is that what? Is that the
well?
Problem,
this could
obviously.
Be it. You do go to hot yoga. That's in, not cheap.
That is
so.
God no. That's taking a lot of my disposable
I'm
time.
I'm sure
moment.
It is.
Although yeah, but yeah, no. I know what you mean. Yes, we can't go back to using rags.
I'd rather not.
Although I tell you now. I really am gonna any listeners who were sticking with us till this point are now going to go, but I'm going to talk about my moon cup, Amanda. I really am. And maybe this is why I'm not too excited about the tampon issue, is because I am a moon cup user. And it has changed my life. It's unbelievable.
So happy for you.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't mean anything. I knew the initial outlay, which is it's about 15 quid, and you think, this is ridiculous. But oh my goodness, it's an incredible journey. It's an incredible journey to go on. And I really don't want to go into too much graphic detail because I fear that people will retch if we start talking about blood. But hey, why not? But no, you catch all your blood in a cup. I mean, come on, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
You get to see how much comes out, which is fascinating.
That must be fascinating because
absolutely.
You know, there's always that... You know, you're always told that it's only an egg cup full, and
but
it feels
well. It's more than that. I don't know if I'm unusual, but no, it's quite a yield. and I'm so sorry, everyone. Shall I go a bit more gross? Do you think I can go
do
one
it.
Step?
This is the one place you can do it. You're in
I'm
a safe,
gonna
you're
go
in a safe
one
area here.
Step grosser, and I can only apologise. We can't back out now. I had a sniff. Had a sniff. There was a cupful, and I just thought, I'll have a sniff. Because Jermaine Greer in the female unit
encouraged us all to taste.
You said
yeah.
You've got to taste it. I didn't go that far. I wasn't prepared to taste it, but.
Tastes like chicken.
Jermaine Greer, she said, you know, if you find that disgusting, you've got to think about why it's so disgusting. And so anyway, but I did have a sniff, and I went, oh, that smells a bit like red wine. and I didn't drink it, even though I'm fond of red wine. And I said this to another moon cup using friend of mine. I said, oh, does it smell of red wine? And my friend went, no.
No.
And I said, that is just how much wine I've obviously been drinking, that it's seeping out of me in every way. So, listeners, I apologise. I tell you what, though, because we've got the Teachers of Peaches as our album of the week, I feel we are going to go into slightly darker territory. Mm. So it's probably good at the top of the show to establish that this will be a little more adult in theme and content.
Hang on to your hats.
And gross and disgusting.
Hopefully.
I tell you, really good gross story, actually, from this week. My child, who is four, when we had our elderly neighbours round for a cup of tea, And my child came in while the elderly neighbours were sat there with a cup of tea with something in her hand. And she said, "Oh, Mummy, I was in the bathroom and there was a hair. And I think it's one of the hairs that you and Daddy have growing out of your bottoms." And then she'd made a sort of toilet paper platter that she'd then put a pubic hair on, which she then showed around the room. Which I don't normally tell cute kid stories, but that was quite... I mean, it was...
And how did the elderly neighbours react?
They laughed heartily.
To this? Yeah, well, as they should,
fine.
As they should.
They're very good. They are very... very good fun. Yes. Edna was... She was amused. She's a good woman. She's a good woman, Edna, if you're listening. I hope you're not. I really hope you're not, actually. That would just compound the whole being shown my pubic hair. It probably wasn't mine. It was probably my husband's. Anyway... good. So, yes. So, tampon tax. Actually, we did mention Jermaine Greer. Shall we discuss Jermaine Greer now that we're on a roll? Because just, again, what I've done is I've put two stories at the top of the show that I'm not entirely sure what I think about them. So actually they're open to discussion. And what we can do is when Viv Groskop, our lovely studio guest,
I was about to say, if you like, we can go to a track because Viv is here, so we can go and get to her and bring her in. Yes.
Yeah, go on, let's do that then. Perfect.
All right. So do you want to finish what you were going to say first?
No, well, basically, should I set it up and then we can see? Let's see what we think that Viv will say. Basically, so Jermaine Greer, talking at the Hay Festival, said that the fact that David Furnish, Elton John's husband, is listed on their children's birth certificate as mother, that this was an insult to the concept of motherhood, I think. So anyway, and then she also said some quite sort of nuts things about abortion, which we will discuss when Viv Groskop arrives. Should we go and get her?
Yes. Yes, we're going to play a track.
All right,
once that's
then.
Going on, we're going to play Fuck the Pain Away.
Oh, good, another Peaches. Right, now this one actually does justify Fubar's, you know, it's they're swearing in this. It says fuck a lot. There it goes. Yes, that's more like it. That was Fuck the Pain Away by Peaches. I should explain to my lovely studio guest, Viv Groskop, who is here. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. We were just, in your absence, we were talking, this is our record of the week, is The Teachers of Peaches. Are you familiar with it?
I am not familiar with this work.
Well, let me talk you through it. So picture the year, 2000. It's the dawn of a new millennium, and I am a young girl about town living in London. And this album came into my life, and it's possibly... she's sort of... Canadian, I think, performance artist kind of woman, and she gets signed by this German sort of electro clash label to make this record. And I heard it and I thought, oh my goodness, this is really quite something. And not my usual kind of thing at all, but I loved it and I played it all the time, including when I had invited a very sweet, polite young man who had taken me out for dinner, and that was not really... I sort of quite fancied him, but it wasn't like a sort of, it wasn't a date really. But any thought I had of anything happening was soon destroyed by the fact that he came back to my flat and I just put the stereo on and that song came on. And it looked like the worst, most clumsy seduction technique. Because then I was like, oh, I can't really turn it off because then it's going to look even more embarrassing. I just blushed my way through it.
Well, it's the ideal track for giving birth, though.
Yes.
Isn't it, though?
It's got all...
I thought that was what you were going to say, you see, that you started off having it as your anthem to your youth and then it turns out having a different story.
Gosh, that's a brilliant... Because it's got that very low rumble that would actually be quite useful.
Yeah, you could have that on repeat for about 6 hours.
Yeah.
You'd be all right.
Oh, well, there. But you see, I knew that you would come in with good advice and wisdom, Viv Gross. But I've been very much looking forward to having you on the show.
I'm very excited to be here.
For so
there's
many
a
reasons.
Massive complement of PIMs available.
Yeah, that's hour two is PIMs hour. So we sit and look at them. Like dogs at the dinner table,
right,
we sit looking at the cans of PIMS for the first hour and then we're allowed to...
Okay, I'll sit on my hands for now. Then.
and then because what I try to do is get the meatier stories out of the way in the first hour, and then the second hour we just giggle.
Great. Bring on the meat.
Yes, well, I say meaty. I've just been talking about the first two things we've discussed, which were Tampon Tax and Jermaine Greer. And I was very wishy-washy about both of them. Tampon Tax, I have just explained in more detail than is necessary that it doesn't apply to me because I use a moon cup.
Oh, that's too much information.
I know,
Lucy.
You weren't here to hear how much information there was. It was way too much information.
That's one of the highlights of my comedy career, such as it is, was following a moon cup demonstration, which had gone on for half an hour.
I'm sorry about that.
Some comedy!
Where, sort of put me off a bit. Where was the moon cup demonstration?
It was at some... women's event, naturally, in the East London area. Yes, and unfortunately, I think the moon cup demonstration was slightly more popular than me.
Do you know, I really should make myself available for these, given how graphic I've been about the face and vagina of the moon cup.
Yeah.
Here she is. Yeah, no, I'd be delighted. I endorse their product fully. I'm not even being paid to say it, and I've given them more airtime than they could ever possibly have dreamed of. But yes, Tampon Tax. Oh, there was a word which I just found and then lost again, but it was just the whole Tampon Tax story alerted me to a word which the Australians use, which I had never heard before, which was the word furphy.
How are we spelling that?
F-U-R-P-H-Y. Furphy. Let's play Call My Bluff. What do you think furphy means? Is it a type of horse? Is it a water cart? Or is it Australian slang for a rumour?
For a rumour?
Mm-hmm.
So a piece of gossip?
Yes, a furphy is Australian slang for a rumour or an erroneous or improbable story, but usually claimed to be absolute fact.
It's a bit of a furphy.
Yeah. Too right, mate. It's a furphy.
And what's the derivative from?
The word is derived from water carts designed and made by a company established by John Furphy of Shepparton, Victoria. The carts with J. Furphy and Sons written on their tanks became popular as gathering places where soldiers could exchange gossip, rumours and fanciful tales, much like today's water cooler discussion. And this, it cropped up in an article about the tampon tax, and I found that quite interesting. I thought furphy is a good word.
Can you remember what the furphy was referring to?
The furphy, I think she'd used it. It was in the Guardian, so it may have been a mistake.
Oh, that's full of furphies.
It's full of furphies.
It's furphy central, the Guardian.
They should call it furphy.co.uk.
I hope no Australians are listening to this.
No, I've never been able to do an Australian
accent.
Although, actually, when I try and do another accent, often that comes out as Australian. I did once, I was employed on a cartoon series to do an American accent and got lots of very complimentary fan letters saying, who's that lovely Australian woman with the nice voice? So there you go. You can do it accidentally, possibly. But yes, but the furphy... Well, there is a furphy attached to the tampon tax story that I wished to discuss, which is I've seen on a lot of places people saying it's so unfair that tampons are not VAT zero rated, they have 5% VAT, when men's razors are VAT free. But that is a furphy, because everyone's saying it and it ain't true. And I went to some degree of painstaking research which involved looking at VAT websites for way longer than anyone should have to.
You really give to the people, Lucy.
I really
Porter.
Give them things they don't want. Intimate information about my moon
cup.
You
give of your time on the VAT website.
I do. Well, I like to research.
And that is quite shocking, though, isn't it, actually, about the razors? Because it is a common misnomer that women are so hard done by, and if only our luxury items could not be taxed.
Yes.
And no one else's luxury items are taxed. And it makes it all a bit...
I always say it in that kind of voice as well.
Yes, it punctures... Punctures the balloon of pomposity slightly.
I know one of
to know that Gillette and other available brands of razor are equally taxed.
They are equally taxed. Although women's razors, I think, are more expensive than men's, you know, like your generic disposable razor. I think if they call it a women's razor, they do bung a couple of pence on it for painting it pink.
So we are more heavily taxed.
Well, I mean, yeah, we're very hard done by, Viv. Let's never forget that.
No, that's
Let's
right.
Let's never forget that fact.
Terribly, terribly, terribly hard
but
done
it is,
by.
I mean, yes, it's, you know, I mean, would sanitary protection be free if men had periods? We can only guess. But probably not.
I just don't like this line of argument. I don't want to think about men having periods. It's just an unpleasant thought.
Hey, well, you really are lucky that you missed the whole moon cup. If a man had a moon cup, then imagine...
He wouldn't be such a pretty face of the moon cup.
Imagine...
I won't say of what else as well, yes. As your good self.
And the Jermaine Greer story, we hadn't really... I mean, I just sort of teed it up. That at the Hay Festival, Jermaine Greer made suggested that it was wrong that David Furnish, Elton John's husband, was named as the mother of their children on their birth certificate.
Mm. Well, it is technically speaking inaccurate on a number of levels.
Well, it's
I'm sure that's
of,
what she's getting at.
Yes.
She's quite a pedant, is old Jermaine.
She's angry a lot of the time. Do you know, though, I met her and I was terrified. This is back in the 90s and I was absolutely terrified. You know, loved her, loved the female eunuch. Was slightly terrified about meeting her, and she absolutely justified being terrified of her because she was fierce, absolutely fierce, but also brilliant. And bonkers, and we discussed our favourite A roads for quite some time.
Hers is always a good standby. That
A56 is hers. Hmm. I was really unable to give a definitive answer, but I said I quite like the A3. She was a marvellous woman. I always find it difficult to comment on things like this because I haven't read the whole transcript of whatever she was saying at Hay, and it's always, things taken out of context by the Daily Mail always make you slightly panic that we've misconstrued what she says. But she's a dangerous radical thinker. She's going to say some slightly dangerous things.
She does get very angry about random things. Mm. And it's quite interesting because I've met her as well, Lucy.
Good.
She's met both of us.
Yeah, she's very lucky.
And I also was terrified until I realised that I met her at a literature festival at Bath, where I do lots of stuff because that's where I come from. Mm-hmm. And I realised there was this sort of 5-mile exclusion zone around her, which no one will penetrate, literally and metaphorically, because everyone is so terrified of her. And I thought, I'm going to have to be the person who goes into the exclusion zone. Yeah. And we had a very interesting talk, not about A-roads, but about iPads.
There you go.
Yes. Similar.
She's actually quite trivial.
Yeah.
Turns out.
But she does go to these
things.
Turns out
she's just dull.
Well, she's dull until you put a microphone in front of her, and then she will say any random thing. And she gets very angry about things and then forgets about them. So yes. I think probably tomorrow she'll forget that she said this.
Yes.
Because she said all kind of other crazy things about mothers before. She's not in favour of children.
She
by any
child,
stretch. No, I don't think she does.
Oh, does she not? Oh. I could understand her not being in favour if she
stretch,
had them. You know,
she has no interest in children. She thinks children are awful. Mm. So she probably is trying to protect Elton John in her mind.
Okay.
Possibly.
Yes. Well, let's not guess at her motivation, but... Yeah. Well,
let's.
Yes. Is she drunk? Because that's what I do. When I'm drunk, I tend to get very angry about something. And then the next day, I'm like, God, I really did. This is why Pim's hour is actually a little bit more interesting, because then I can get very worked up. I should warn you as well, Viv. Now, I haven't really introduced you properly, Viv. You are Viv Groskop. You are a woman with more strings to her bow than Vanessa May.
I'm aging myself there.
You've got a lovely big bow. Vanessa May, doesn't it? That's a bit of an old reference, isn't it, Vanessa May? She's a skier now, a disgraced skier.
Was she on one of those reality programmes then?
No.
She
entered the Olympics.
Did she?
Skiing for Britain, yeah. But then I think there was some controversy. I say disgraced skier, that's wrong. That's very wrong of me. I think there was a controversy, but I don't know if she is disgraced or not. But controversial skier. Vanessa May, you've got as many strings to your bow, Viv Groskop, as anyway.
As one-time violinist.
Played the violin, Vanessa May, because you are a journalist, a broadcaster, a stand-up comedian, an excellent stand-up comedian who's preparing her second act for the Edinburgh Festival this year. Yes. We'll talk about that later. And also an agony aunt. Mm. And it's in that capacity that we will be talking about later on. And I have picked every week I pick a woman of the week who I think is relevant to the studio guest and is worth sharing. And I have picked someone whose life story I will not be able to tell without crying. So I'm wondering if we should save
goodness.
That for Pim's hour. Maybe we should save that.
Yeah, let's get really, really weepy.
And maudlin and...
Yeah, that sounds great.
Good, because we might end up phoning her son.
That sounds amazing.
Well, I'm building it up now. But anyway, that's going to be That's going to be in Pim's hour, guys. Just hang on for Pim's hour. There's going to be crying. You think the Mooncut revelations were bad. You just wait until hour two. God knows what's going to happen. But we will also be discussing your journalistic work, because I wanted to start off.
You make it sound very grand.
You are quite grand.
Journalistic
you
work.
You are grand.
Some scribblings.
You have to get used
tippy
to being
tappy,
grand.
Tippy-tappy on the keyboard.
I know.
That's all it is.
Don't try and demystify it. It's you're a very talented woman. Because every week we do a list. We compile a list throughout the show. And do you know what? Like, normally we get people emailing and tweeting and stuff. We did one a couple of weeks ago, which was all about toilets. It was the list was meant to be name things that are unequivocally better about being a woman. But we basically ended up just getting sidetracked into talking about the difference between men's and women's toilets. Mm-hmm. And we've had some lovely, lovely contributions on that level. But the list we did last week, we've had not a single email.
No.
For the first time, nobody was interested. And do you know the awful thing is I can't even remember what it was.
It was weddings. How can we make weddings less...
Oh, less sexist less sexist. Gendered.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you see, people won't message about that because they like weddings.
Yeah, they
people
do.
Like weddings.
And people like the traditional, awful sexist.
Yeah, it's
nonsense.
The one day when people allow themselves to be massively sexist.
Yeah. Well, in our discussion of it last week, which we won't revive for too long because obviously people don't
no,
like
it's very unpopular.
But, but we'll just get, yes, because, you know, I did wear white. I wore white.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
I wore a pale pink.
Good for bloody you, although it's still pink.
Well, no, it was a bit Jordan. It was Jordan before Jordan. At the time, I thought it was quite a subversive choice.
Yes.
And then about 10 years later, Jordan made the same choice.
Well, then, so, I would argue you could see Jordan's
I didn't
an
have
ancient
a matching
subversion.
Carriage, sadly.
No.
I didn't go the whole carriage.
That is a shame. So the list we're going to do this week relates to a very brilliant article that you wrote as recently as today, I think it was published.
This very morning.
Were you slaving over this last night?
I wrote this morning, actually.
You did actually write it this morning?
Yes.
And it's already online, isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't life wonderful?
It's the wonder of the internet.
And it's for the new online magazine, The Pool, which you are involved with.
The Pool is where I'm the agony aunt. I do Dear Viv, Waving Not Drowning, and people write in and I reply to them. It's in a podcast, but they also publish a transcript of it.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, which is great actually, because then you can access it via two different media. So exciting.
You can read along and pretend to be you.
Yes, exactly.
That's something I'm
but yeah,
do
The Pool is it started up about 2 months ago, I think, and it's founded by Lauren Laverne and Sam Baker, formerly of Cosmopolitan and Red magazines. Mm-hmm. And it's a brilliant, I mean, I would say this because I work for it, but it's a brilliant thing in that it's purely designed to respond to the way that people access stuff online. Mm-hmm. So whereas most magazines, women's magazines, say, oh, what do we want to do? Let's put it online.
Yeah.
They take it the complete opposite way of how are people consuming stuff online? In what format do they want to get this? And then they try and create stuff that responds to that need.
Okay.
So that's the ethos behind it, which I think is really interesting. And it's quite experimental and funny.
Well, and I like the fact that you are bunging it out at people in various formats.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can read it, you can listen to it.
Yeah, it's great sort of, you know, I like people who sort of throw things at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
And you can do that online.
Well, it's because we talked when Tanya Edwards was in, we were talking about Standard Issue, which was a magazine that launched a little while previously, which was kind of more traditional magazine format.
Sarah Millican's project. Yeah.
Yeah, with Sarah Millican, Sarah Pascoe, loads of amazing women are contributing to it. And it is, it's sort of, again, it's sort of similarly, you know, I suppose it's a women's magazine, you know, online that is sort of trying also not to be a bitchy women's magazine that makes women feel bad about themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that has become a big problem for women's magazines, actually. Mm. And most of them admit it, that if you do any survey, then all of the readers and all the focus groups say, oh, I love this magazine, and when I stop reading it, I go away and have a little cry because my life is so rubbish and unlike that of the people in the magazine.
Oh, no!
And, they generally do say this. And, you know, anyone who's read a magazine knows that they feel that way.
It's a form of self-torture.
It is. And, it's the same reason that the Daily Mail has a predominantly female readership. And they have, you know, female section of the Daily Mail is particularly self-flagellating.
Yeah, the masochistic streak in all of
it. Yeah, so anything that fights back against that without being too worthy.
Yes.
Because it is a bit worthy, and we do like a bit of masochism from time to time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I suppose beauty and fashion are not off limits, you know. I mean, they are to me, but in a more general sense, they're not.
With your moon cup.
With my moon cup. That's all I'm really interested in, is my moon cup. But I, the kind of article that it interests me is this that you have written, which is, it concerns one of these studies by US consulting giant Bain & Company, which has found that you have to act like a man to get ahead at work. But then if you do act like a man, you will also get harassed and penalised for not being feminine enough.
Yes. And damned if you do, damned if you don't,
bloody
woman.
Well don't. And you've written an excellent article about how we don't have to put on our man hats, which you can find at thepool.co.uk.
Yes, in this study report, they did particularly refer to the man hat, which was hilarious.
Yeah. Women are putting on man hats.
It was not a term I'd ever
known of before.
No, they actually referred, they say, even when they did put on their man hats, they were disrespected. And I thought, how sad this is, actually. I could have written an awful lot more about this. And yes. I'm glad it struck a chord with you, Lucy. I wasn't entirely happy with this piece, because it's one of these things where you're just touching the tip of an iceberg.
Yeah.
And for me, I just wanted to rip the entire report to shreds.
Yeah.
And I often do write about surveys and studies and things, and I think they are interesting because there must be some grain of truth in them, because they've gone to, you know, this was 1,000 people.
Yeah, the sample size was adequate.
Yeah, you can't sort of just totally disregard it. But I often think that the terms of reference are so incredibly weighted.
Yes.
And they'd obviously ask people very leading questions.
Yeah.
You know, already when you ask somebody, do you ever act like a man at work, you're suggesting that is a thing that people do.
Men behave in a certain way and women behave in another way. Yeah,
I don't think it is a thing that anyone does.
This is why I love your article so much, that it does seem, if I may quote you, something very strange is happening at the moment. It's almost as if there's a dual world, the world we know about and see all around us and the world we read about in surveys. In the real world, I'm not really sure that we see any shoulder-padded, sharp-elbowed bitch women straddling the boardroom in a Reese jumpsuit and a man hat. Although this is possibly how I see myself in my more aggressive dreams. My man hat is a bishop's mitre. I love the image of that. And also I love the fact that you have managed to crowbar in your obsession with jumpsuits, even into
this
piece.
That's right. Yes, I do love a jumpsuit.
About entirely unrelated.
Well, a slimmer inner me loves a jumpsuit, let's say that.
I love a jumpsuit. But yeah, in the real world, how many men have you met who play golf with their boss to get ahead? I'm 41. I've met thousands of people. I've never met anyone who fits this stereotype. Something close to this must exist in corporate America, otherwise people would not have expressed these views in a survey. But it does not mean we have to identify with it. And that is, to me, the bloody nub of the entire thing, is absolutely that there's this kind of world of people talking about gender and about the way that we behave. I just don't ever see in my life. I never feel like, with my husband and I, we never talk about what, you know, we don't split our television watching along gender line. You know, it's not that, I'm watching my soaps and he's watching, you know, Top Gear or, you know, and I do think I don't think we're that unusual. I think that there are a lot of, you know, the outdated stereotypes that we allow to persist because we just kind of accept these bullshit surveys.
Yeah, and I think that there is a tendency now as well, especially online, because everybody's looking for something that's going to go viral, for these outrageous, stereotypical end of the pier ideas where, oh, you've got to wear a man hat to get on at work.
Yeah.
And these things can very quickly go viral because there are a lot of people like us are saying, well, this is ridiculous.
Yes.
No one wears a man hat. And actually these things get taken up and perpetuated. So I sometimes do write about these things with a bit of caution as well, because I'm wary of actually becoming part of the myth.
Yeah.
And so if I do write about these things, I'm always trying to say, please don't take this at face value. This
but
is a nonsense.
What we could talk about inspired by it. But
yeah,
I know it is difficult because, I mean, surveys are 99% of what fills the tabloids now, really. I mean, it's the easiest way for a brand to get a bit of PR. And I have, in fact, indulged in a bit of this where I got paid to do a day of talking about a survey that some company had done on the radio. I was upholding the very thing that we despise, but it was something very innocuous about. God, I can't even remember. Isn't that terrible? I can't remember what it was. Anyway.
So what was your role? Your role was
so
just to discuss the survey.
Have to go on every local radio station in Britain.
Right.
And say, oh, God, what was it now? I see, it'll come back to me. But, yes, it was some...
I'd love it if it was the Moon Cup.
It will. God, if only.
And now on BBC Wiltshire, we're going to talk about Moon Cups.
I believe you use a Moon Cup, Lucy, don't you? Anyway, here's Depeche Mode. It's an easy way for brands to get noticed. But it's also increasingly an easy way for academics to get noticed, for, you know, consulting companies. Everyone's in on
yeah,
the... It's like lists. It's like the clickbait lists.
In some ways
lists.
As well, I do think it has a certain validity, these surveys, because we love to know what other people think.
Yeah.
And they do give you a weird, often overblown measure of something that people think. Mm. And when you drill down into the facts, it's often... Oh, it was actually only 37%, but we've sort of rounded it up to about a half.
Always the great thing in when you're doing this day that I did with all the local radio stations is they give you the statistics relating to the areas you're talking to. So if you are going through to, you know, BBC West Midlands, then they say, and it was 38% of people in the West Midlands said X, and then you realise, oh yeah, no, 38%, that's two people in
yes,
the West Midlands.
Exactly.
Survey
exactly.
sample.
So, yeah. No, it's a tricky one. And American surveys as well, you know, this was interesting because I'm sure that lots of the people in this survey, it sounds like they're all corporate and it's, you know, management consultancy type companies and accountants and things. And I'm sure in America, maybe they do all go and play golf the whole time.
Yeah.
But I truly, as I put in the piece, have never met anyone here who's felt like they have to join in with that.
Well, now this is going to lead us on to the list that we're going to compile, which is sexism you have experienced or observed in the workplace. Mm. And this can be, dear listeners, anything that, you know, I was thinking about this because... Reading your article, I remembered when I was working in television production in the 1990s, and the a production that I was involved with, the producer took all the men who worked on the production to a strip club, the Fantasy Bar in Manchester.
Nice.
And said, oh, don't tell the women in the office. And of course they told us because they were boys who were really we felt really bad because, you know, he told us not to tell. And I was absolutely shocked by that, and all of the women, we were all up in arms and got a fulsome apology, which was fine. But it was, it was just interesting because then I told friends of mine who worked in the City of London, and she went, oh, yeah, no, that happens all the time. I mean, that's just a thing that guys go to strip clubs and, you know. And that completely shocked me that was standard practice. I don't know if it still is. I don't know people who work in the city anymore. None of my friends are that successful. Define successful indeed. Very spoken like a true agony aunt there, Viv, yes. So that kind of, because there have been, you know, obviously things like suggesting something in a meeting and then 5 minutes later a man suggests it and then it's taken up by the group.
Yes, that's the Caroline Quentin Fast Show character, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly.
Yes. Is that right? Is it her?
I can't remember.
There is a character
there is
like
one,
that, though,
yeah.
Yes.
The
Invisible Woman.
The podium, was it?
Oh. Invisible Woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Sort of other stark examples. I was doing a gig a few years back, and it was a works do.
Oh, Arabella Weir, it's just come
to me, Arabella.
Sorry.
Oh, my God, and I'm quite friendly with Arabella Weir. She'll be furious. Sorry, Arabella. she's brilliant. She'll be on the show one day. We can apologise then. So I was doing this gig, this corporate entertainment in Manchester with some other comedians a few years back. And, you know, works do's are always quite hard work. And this one in particular was horrific. There were four comics on... and we all died slow, painful, horrible deaths. But we sort of had to do our time because it was one of those situations. Like in a comedy club, you know, you can just get off and the owner will say, oh, thanks for just getting off the stage and saving the night. But when it's a corporate event, often the people who are running it don't understand how comedy works. And if you don't do your time, then they refuse to pay you. So at corporate events, I have stood there, you know, dying horrifically, but going, I have to wait until the second my watch ticks to 20 minutes and then I can get off and go. And I mean, it doesn't happen often, I should point that out. I'm a very competent and capable performer.
Obviously.
But there are occasions when in all comedians' lives when this happens. And so we all died horrifically painfully. And we were in the car on the way back home and we started going, oh, God, yeah, terrible gig. And all the blokes in the car, the three men, said, oh, well, God, at least the money was worth it then. And I was like, I mean, it was all right, but it wasn't, was it? And it emerged that all three of these men were being paid at least three times as much as I was. And there is a punchline to this story, because the employer for whom we were doing the corporate gig was the Northwest branch of the Labour Party. And I have since spoken spoken to Labour Party people about it and said, how could that happen? And they kind of, oh, yeah, it's quite bad. That is quite bad, isn't it? Because if I'd gone to the papers, they would have had a field day, I'm sure. But, that was painful. So that's, you know,
The Conservative Party would have given you parity.
I would have
parity,
had to get my tits
sure.
out, but they would have paid me well to do it. Amanda and Viv, do you have any incidents that you wish to share?
Something really springs to mind, not in the current industry that I work in, thankfully so much, but in a few years ago, I was a waitress, quite a few years ago, but I mean, obviously you're going to get the general sexism with, you know, from the punters, but the restaurant that I worked in, it was in Kensington High Street, so it was, you know, we used to get quite, you know, a lot of people from local business, the Daily Mail. So it was quite, you know, a nice restaurant.
Rich people.
Yeah, lots of rich people. They never tip. And he said to me, we're advertising for more waiting staff, but if any guy calls, tell him the job's gone. And I said, well, why? And he said, because men like to be served by women.
Mm.
And I said, but do you think that the women that come in here might like to be served by a man? And that's something that's really stayed with me, actually. It's just the really blasé way that he said it.
Yeah.
As well, like, well, just men like to be served by women.
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, offensive on
many levels.
Surprised he didn't say, well, women don't care who's serving them as long as the puddings are nice. I mean, there is a grain of truth in that in my case, but I would not extend that to all women. But yeah, that's, I mean, it's, I have only really worked in, well, no, that's not true. I have had office jobs, but largely I've worked in areas where it's very difficult. It would be very difficult to go to HR, like, you know, in restaurants and bars and things like that. And, you know, and in comedy as well, it's like, well, with comedy, you get really open sexist abuse from your male colleagues on occasion, you know, under the guise of banter. But, you know, you do sort of feel, but you can, there is a comeback to that, and it's the sort of, it is the kind of workplace where you feel that you can, you know, you can get away with, or, you know, you can complain openly and be heard. I think.
Sorry, which workplaces?
In comedy.
In comedy, you know, you feel like you can complain.
Well, yeah, I feel like.
Who are you going to complain to?
Well, like, yeah, there's no official recourse.
There's no ombudsman.
No.
Combudsman.
But, you know, you can moan about it to the promoter and to the comics themselves, I suppose. I feel I've had a lot of robust exchanges of ideas with.
Yeah, I think it is a workplace in massive inverted commas.
Massive inverted commas.
Not very worky workplace.
Pub.
Where you can, if somebody says something to you, you just say back, sorry, you shouldn't have said that, it's easy. Whereas I can see in the waitress situation, you can't really say, excuse me, but what you have said is inappropriate.
Well, I did pull him up on it.
Did you?
Oh, of course, yeah, because
well,
I was
done.
Absolutely appalled. I thought it was really unfair to any guys that rang up wanting a job as well.
Yeah.
So
response?
I just, they didn't take any notice of me, though.
Did they just hire
a really pretty
women,
blonde girl to come and serve the table? So, Yeah.
I mean, it's always, there's a brilliant website and Twitter feed, which is Casting Call Woe.
Oh, yeah, that is brilliant.
Which is a brilliant actress who has basically, she takes all the casting calls. Because, I mean, acting, obviously, I mean, you sort of openly can discriminate because it's like we're looking for, and it's always really depressing reading, but it's also quite funny. Casting Call Woe, and you will see the descriptions that people put out for actors and actresses that they're looking for. And it isn't actually just, you know, I mean, it has become over recent years just as demeaning for men as it is for women. Some of the descriptions of the physical attributes people are looking for when they're casting their low budget short film. It's always the people who want you to work for free as well. It's always like, you know, this woman must have the face of Angelina Jolie and the body of Charlize Theron, and, you know, we will provide sandwiches filming in Stevenage in the middle of November. You know, it's like, yeah, I think you might need to lower your standards. Lower your standards a bit there. But anyway, if anyone out there has... Viv Goscombe, have you got anything?
Well, the one thing springs to mind for me, one of the first jobs I did when I first came to London and I wanted to be a writer and I was in deep denial of my desire to do comedy, which surfaced many years later, is I worked on the Daily Express.
Oh.
And I was an editor there and a columnist, and I worked for a long time as a desk feature writer, where it's when everybody, and actually a lot of the men used to do this more than the women, would go and hide in the toilets after the newspaper conference every morning. So conference is about 10 o'clock in the morning where they decide what the stories are for the next day.
Yeah.
But everyone would go and hide in the toilet so they didn't get asked to do anything.
Oh, no.
It took me ages, ages to cotton on to this. Yeah. So I was always the sucker who was writing some terrible story on Edition about Gwyneth Paltrow's hair extensions on one memorable occasion. I had to go to the hairdresser the same day and have my hair put in Gwyneth Paltrow's hair extensions and be photographed crying.
Oh my God, I always feel for those people.
Horrific.
You were that person.
I was that person, yeah. Is anyone around to do a stunt feature? Is anyone around to do a stunt feature? And I remember finding out that one of my colleagues, who was a particular toilet hider, mm-hmm. and who I was writing about 10 features a week. This is before the internet, and he was writing about one a fortnight, and I found out that he was on double pay. And we were the same age, we'd been going the same amount of time, there was nothing to choose between us really. Except for I worked 10 times as hard as he did, like an absolute sucker.
Well, was
I complained to my editor, yeah. And my editor said, well, we pay enough to keep you in shoes, don't we?
Oh, no.
I can't believe that story just got worse, but it just got...
God, it's
I did wear particularly nice shoes at the time, and I was grateful that that was noted, but I would have wanted more.
Did you say, are you referring specifically to my shoes because they are nice, or is this a general sexist comment about women's love of shoes?
I think the person who made this comment thought it was general to me, but I remember thinking... I want to buy a house. I would like to buy a house.
Well, I had a comedy promoter say to me when I was chasing money for a gig that he owed me, and he said in a kind of jokey way, he went, oh, come on, Lucy. Not like you need the money. Your husband's doing all right at the minute, isn't he? And I was like, it's my job is not a hobby. This is not to,
For many years, I would say to people, you know, the party thing, what do you do? And I would say, I'm a freelance writer, which I still am, really, and probably always will be. And people say, oh, right, what does your husband do? Because obviously you can't make a living from that.
Yeah.
But that's not sexist. It's probably more anti-freelance.
Yeah. It's probably more
valid.
Everybody
on a lot of occasions
that freelance writers are increasingly badly paid. But you are now a world-class stand-up comedian, so I'm going to talk about
that. That's right, world-class.
World-class stand-up comedian. That's one of those... I love that as a compliment, because it doesn't really mean anything, but it sounds quite good, doesn't it?
I mean, I'm going to use that now.
World-class
stand-up
comedian.
World-class. World-class. Bar radio.
Lucy Porter, Fubar. Can I have my name on the poster? At least, if you're going to use the quote. I want my name. But let's talk about that after we've had a record, shall we? What should we listen to? Maybe?
It's contentiously linked to the subject that we've just been talking about.
Oh.
It's Work
Nine
It.
9 to 5.
No. Aww. No.
My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard.
It's...
Viv's not naming a song. She's just making a statement.
Yes. Because what then. Happens on a Saturday? It's Work It by Missy Elliott.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's got
see
work.
What I mean?
It's
yes,
got work in
I
the title.
There?
We can do that. And Fib's doing her Missy Elliott dance, which looks like she's riding a horse in a circle.
The Lucy Porter Show on FUBAR Radio.
Viv's just heard my sting for the first time. That's my sting.
It's the Lucy Porter Show.
Yeah, that's a man called Ali who does that.
What a charmer.
Yeah, well, I normally do. Well, I say normally. I've done it once, I think, that I try and sing a sting for the guest that I have in. But nothing rhymes with Groskop.
No.
I mean, it's
Hot Pot's not far off.
Viv Groskop, she's as tasty as a hot pot.
It was nearly there. It was nearly there. You just lacked commitment.
I know.
On
well,
the
I sort of. You could say I was sort of wavering. I was thinking, what shall I do with hot pot? And I did something very uninteresting with it.
It was close.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll work on that. We can work on that. If anyone can think of anything that rhymes with Groskop,
degree.
No, let's not.
Let's not do that.
But yeah, sexism at work. You could. The problem is, producer Amanda's gone out of the room, and I now can't remember how people can get in touch. Well, they can do at FUBAR on Twitter.
Yeah, that'll
tweet us. Tweet us something if you want, or don't if you don't. So now, Viv, we're going to talk about your comedy career, which I find interesting for any, you know, a huge amount of reasons, because you came to it, like you say, for years not realising you wanted to do it, and I was the same.
Really?
I was the same, although, I mean, admittedly, I did start when I was about 22, but I think since I was a child, I had wanted to do stand-up and had never realised, and the thing that kind of made me realise was that I went out with a comedian and suddenly realised, oh no, hang on, what I'm doing is I'm going out with someone.
Who was this comedian? You say who it is?
Oh, I don't know if I should really.
Okay, I'm just saying because I don't know who it is. Maybe I should remember. But anyway,
I was young. We were both young. Let's not remind him of painful
okay,
time.
So you realised you were going out with someone because you actually wanted their life.
I actually wanted their life, yes. And so that was my realisation, was I was like, actually, I want to be doing this, not having sex with someone who does it. So what was your path to...
I want to have sex with someone who does it now. I can't do that. I've married to someone who isn't a comedian.
Well, you can start doing
I had a midlife crisis, really, I would say. Mini midlife crisis when I was in my mid to late 30s. So this is sort of 4 or 5 years ago, where I just suddenly, having had quite an independent life, because I became freelance when I was 25, 26. And so I'd been a freelance writer for about 10 years, totally in control of everything. So I was never one of these freelancers who sort of secretly wants a job. You know, I loved being independent and being in control of my own time.
Yeah.
But that sort of leaves you nowhere to hide if you suddenly find that you don't really like what you're doing all that much anymore. Because you can't think, oh, I hate my job, I hate my boss.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to give it all up and go travelling.
I'm the boss, you know, so if there's something wrong, I need to sort it out.
Yes.
So I began to get these feelings of being a bit uncomfortable, and I did what every good middle class person does, and I went to see my friend's life coach.
Oh, okay.
So I went to see this, I was going to say awful life coach woman, but actually she kind of was a bit awful, really. She said, what is it that's missing from your life? Answer now! And I just blurted out comedy. And I think a few friends had said to me, who I'd talked to about this feeling of, oh, I don't really know why I'm not feeling that happy about things anymore. And they'd said, well, you know, you don't have much fun in your work.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just ended up being that, yeah, maybe it was going to be this stand-up comedy thing that I would try, and it would scratch an itch. And then the more I went and did a course in it, as, again, many middle-class people now do go and do it, a comedy workshop.
Basically, as soon as you walk into the life coach's office, they just hand you the comedy course brochure and say,
exactly.
There you go. I think you'll find this will do it.
Yeah, so I did that, but I never had it in mind that I would, in inverted commas, become a comedian. And I can remember thinking as I sat there, well, this is ridiculous. I don't want to become a stand-up comedian. I can't believe how ridiculous these people are who are sitting here thinking that, of course, none of them did, and I did.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the day I got home from the first time of doing it, my husband said to me, I've not seen you look this relaxed in 5 years. And that was a real turning point for me as well, because I just thought, oh, I've been a complete bitch for most of the time that you've known me. I better take care of that. And then the more I did it, the more I loved it. And then I ended up doing this crazy experiment of doing 100 gigs in 100
which
consecutive
you've written
nights.
About in your book, which yes. people can purchase. I Loved, I Cried.
Which I did that secretly because I didn't know that I would want to write about it, and I didn't know if it would work. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if it would be a good story. You know, I didn't know if it would be a good story if it did work mm-hmm. or if it didn't. Yeah. So I just did. And also I didn't want to get sympathy gigs, and I didn't want to get blocked from doing gigs as well by people saying, oh, well, you're just doing...
I don't want to be written about or you're not serious about doing comedy.
Yeah, exactly. So mm-hmm. I did it under the radar and then found that I did want to go on with it, and I did love it, and I did want to get really good at it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine anyone not feeling that way. It's so weird to me when people give up doing stand-up. Because I just, you know, I just think, how do you ever do it and then not want to do it all the time? It's like, you know, sex or something, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe it's slightly different for you because, I don't know, from talking to other people who are at the same place as you are, that, you know, you started on the circuit 20 years ago.
Many years ago, yes.
And now it's such a different place.
Yeah, you know, actually, that's true. It was so easy when I started.
Well, no, it's not. I don't think it's ever easy.
No, it is much harder.
But I think the soul-destroying aspects of it are quite to the forefront now.
Yeah.
It's in, like, they are in lots of industries, actually, now that everything has become deprofessionalised. Mm. And the great democracy of the internet, yay!
Yeah.
If you've got money, you can do anything. If you don't have any money, then tough.
You can only
but, you know,
free,
there's so many gigs now that are free.
Yeah.
You have to face whether you're going to set up your own YouTube channel completely unpaid. And navigating all of those things, I think, is quite difficult for people.
Yeah.
So I can see...
Well, I know, because it wasn't a business at all. I mean, that is the app... I mean, I know, you know, it's a real kind of old farts thing, but it was, you know, people were more interesting, acts were more experimental because, you know, it didn't matter if you died so much, whereas now if you're a young actor and you die, then that affects your chances of ever being booked anywhere ever again, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's also more difficult to get booked for decent nights because so much is free now.
Yeah.
And when an audience haven't paid, they're not perhaps as engaged as they might be.
No, I would agree. They haven't invested.
But then I don't know.
Still, it did
I
make
don't...
a more interesting book because if it, the book of my early stand-up journey would have been, yeah, gig went all right, got paid, it's fine. Met one of the other 10 comedians who were working in Manchester and went and had a drink. You know, it was things were much easier. But your book is fascinating because it is, the struggle comes across, and also the fact that having, you know, for all you say, your husband saying how much more relaxed you looked and how great it was, just about how difficult the life. Combining the life of a stand-up comedian and a normal person is on your family and
oh yeah, I mean, and lots of people still say that now. You know, I can name drop now. I did a gig last week with Harry Hill.
Oh,
he was so brilliant. I was so excited, and he was saying, you know, he's got three kids, and it's really, you know, he gets fed up of travelling, and it's a really difficult thing to do. I think even when you're really successful,
because
you end up being away night after night, and although you might be earning loads of money, it's you know, you're still away from your family for two or three months.
Yeah.
So it's an incredibly weird job, really.
And because it is also so much about satisfying your own ego, because that the thrill and the enjoyment of it is really, I mean, you know, a lot of it is creative fulfillment and expressing your thoughts and stuff. But then a lot of it is also just the gratification of being on stage and people laughing. And it feels really nice, I think. There is
so you think it's quite a selfish career choice in some ways?
I think I think that it is. You are slightly more aware of that when you have more commitments at home than when you're a single person who is footloose and fancy free. That you sort of think, oh well, you know. I mean, I used to miss friends' birthdays without a thought. You know, I'd be like, oh yeah, no, sorry, I've got a gig, I can't come to your birthday, or your even like weddings and stuff. I'd be like, oh, really sorry, but I'm working. And now that I am older and wiser and, you know, a more rounded
now
human
that you're
being,
not
think,
such a bitch
now that I'm not an absolute cat, because I do look back and think, my god, how have I still got any friends at all, because I was just completely dismissive of everybody else's major life events. I was like, oh yeah, well, sorry, this, my work comes first. But then I think you sort of have to be quite driven to, and I think this does apply across the board to men and women. I think that it's no more difficult really to be a father who is away all the time than it is to be a mum who's away all the time. You are judged more harshly, I think, if you're a mum who's away all the time. But I think it is a very difficult thing to do. And yeah, and I mean, I struggle with it now. I don't do as much as I used to, and I don't think I've got the passion for it that I had maybe once. But in some ways, that's good creatively if you're not so career driven. I guess.
Yeah, I do think that. Yeah, you're right about that idea that ambition, and I mean, I've just jokingly said, you're a bitch, you know. Not know if you knew the truth, because you know, as a woman, it's not so acceptable to say, yeah, do you know what, I'm gonna, you know, I find it extraordinary that people still say to me, oh, how could you do 100 gigs and 100 nights, what about your husband and children, which of course a lot of the book is writing about that and those difficulties, but it's only 3 months, you know. It's not like I abandoned them and they never saw me ever again.
Yeah, and actually a lot of them were quite close to home and you managed to get back. So.
Yeah, exactly. But there is definitely a judgment there on women that it's not so acceptable to be, in inverted commas, a bitch and be ambitious.
Yeah. I know, well, I've crossed the line on stage sometimes because I think you can get away with saying how nice it is to be in a comedy club rather than looking after your children to a certain degree. And I have, you know, said that on many occasions. But if you push it a bit too far, because there have been times, and I, you know, as all parents do, adore my children. I think they're the best in the world. But there have been occasions where I've genuinely been like quite pleased to be in the company of adults working rather than with my children. But if you express that desire or that sentiment kind of with enough passion, you do notice the audience starting to go, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure that she should really be saying this quite as vehemently.
Yes, they feel as if they're encouraging your abusive behaviour.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
I know.
They're complicit in your negligence.
Well, I had a joke that I did on tour, which always went down a storm, but I felt really bad about it on a number of levels, which was... I would talk about being away from the kids when I first went on tour after the kids were born, and I would say, oh, it's you know, my husband's looking after them, don't worry, and it's fine, you know. I phoned him up and he was like, oh, the dinner's on, the kids are in bed, probably just gonna read a book later on or something. And I was thinking, oh, he's incredible. And then I heard his mum's voice in the background, which is true. That was like one of the first times I went away, he'd secretly invited his mum over to stay. And then was coping very well, and I rumbled it. But it was, yeah, it was just really interesting. And audiences loved that because it was like going, oh, she's left her kids, and we're kind of a bit uneasy about that. But now we can laugh at the man in this situation, and there is a woman. There's a woman around involved in looking after the children, and that makes it better somehow. I don't know. I'm psychoanalyzing my audience without really.
That is, I find that worrying. You see, it's worrying because. Yeah, that is the trope of the joke, isn't it? And that's why it works.
Yeah, men can't really look after children. Come on, let's face it. Yeah, I know. Which is, and 99% of the time, of course, it was Justin on his own looking after the kids capably and admirably. But an audience doesn't want to hear that so much as they want to hear he needs his mum to come around and help.
Yes.
Depressing.
They need to be re-educated.
I know, and I wasn't doing it. I've stopped doing that now, but I'm ashamed of myself. Thanks. Good, but the story of you becoming a comedian, I think it illustrates perfectly why you are now fitted for your latest role, which is that of agony aunt.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yes.
Well, you've done something incredible with your life.
Well, the agony aunt, I think, happened sort of by accident. That I was going to be doing some work for the pool and writing for them for this new website, and then. They said, oh, we need someone to do an Agony Aunt podcast. And I said, oh, I'd love to do that. And I thought they would say something like, well, you've never been admitted to the Priory, so you can't do it. although I probably should have been admitted to the Priory on
There's
some,
still
oca-
time,
some
Vince,
occasions.
There's still time.
Let's open
after
the PIMS.
In fact, you know what? Let's get the bloody PIMS. What a good idea. Thank you.
But then I thought, actually, do you know what? I initially thought, am I really qualified to be an Agony Aunt? And I wrote a piece about this because sometimes when I don't know how I feel about something, the best thing to do is write about it and get it out there. And I sort of thought, well, I'm going to write a piece about how unqualified I am to be an agony aunt. And it was through writing that I realised I am actually quite qualified because I've been married for 15 years,
yeah,
which is quite unusual. You know, I married when I was 25. I've got three children.
Yeah.
So I've lived through plenty there. And I had this big, major, you know, career change that was quite... took quite a lot of balls to yes. go through with. So whilst I haven't had some terrible reversal of fortune, mm-hmm. I've had, you know, my share of being in therapy and all of that kind yeah. of thing. And so I thought, yeah, I really want to take this on. And I absolutely love it. I love doing it.
You are brilliant at it. I really love it because you are so calm and so measured and yet reassuring. And you're so... full of lovely praise for the people who've written as well.
Well, I often feel very sorry for them.
Yeah.
People write in with just the most hilariously tortured thoughts about very simple things. So somebody yeah. who wrote in and said, I've just broken up with my boyfriend and I really want to have a makeover, but I think that having a post-breakup makeover is too cliched. What should I do?
Oh,
and I thought, I got quite angry yes. with this. I thought, how pathetic yes. is this? That yes. you're, don't be scared of cliche.
Yeah, yeah, it's a cliche for a reason.
Really important.
It's always good to get a different haircut, isn't it?
And it's interesting that we do have men who write in as well. There was a man who wrote in and said, dear Viv, I've just started going out with a new girlfriend. It's going really well. When do you think I should tell her that I've had sex with men? Because it hasn't come up in conversation yet. And I was very angry with him. Because
he should have known that it's you always do that on date five.
Well, yes, I mean, when is he expecting this to come up in conversation?
Have you had sex with a man? Yeah. I don't know, yeah.
So there's some...
To be fair, I think I have probably asked everyone I've ever slept with that just because I'm very curious by nature. But yeah.
Yeah, so we do get men writing, but we get a lot of women, I guess, probably... you know, aged between really 25 and 45 mostly, but lots of women in their early to mid 30s who just seem to need permission to do really basic things like ask for a pay rise,
yes.
Go for interviews for another job. You know, somebody wrote in saying, oh, I've got all of these interviews coming up. How am I going to sneak out of my office? Well, you know, this is not an illegal behaviour yes. that you're trying to indulge in. You might have to tell a few white lies or think creatively.
Yeah.
Or, you know, pretend that you've got some dental emergency. People get very tortured.
There was
about
a lovely one this week
things.
About a woman who had a friend who was horrible and the friend wanted her to go away on holiday with her. And she was like, oh, but how can I tell her without upsetting her that maybe I should just go on holiday? And it's like, no, don't go on holiday with someone who's horrible, as Stephen so rightly said. But
well,
it was.
I think maybe it's easy for us older ladies, Lucy, as we are.
Experience is a great teacher.
Because I can remember feeling like that when I was 25, of having friends who I didn't particularly like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then now I just think, well, someone you don't particularly like, that's not your friend.
That's not your friend. If they don't make
not
you feel
your
good.
Friend.
Yeah, I know.
But it takes a while.
Well, also, as you get older, you just shed all your friends anyway, don't you?
That's right.
You just kind of get
well. No friends at all
I've
now.
I've lost all of the... my poor husband the other day was sort of going, I feel like I'm a pensioner now. I seem to... It's like, they're not dying. They're just all sort of doing other things, having kids, you know, and you do have that sort of... that 30s thing of going, you think you're in the cast of Friends when you're in your 20s and early 30s, and then in your late 30s you are kind of Steptoe and Son. That's very much how
yes.
my husband and I are at home, irritating each other with no relief.
Yeah, it's true about that Friends thing, actually, because I notice with a lot of the letters that come in that people love feeling like they're part of a drama.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
in some ways, these bad friendships. And also, we had quite a few questions about friends wanting to go away on swanky weekends or do hen parties and weddings. It's all of this. A lot of it's about money and friendship.
That is the Mumsnet staple. That's always on Mumsnet. There's always a bit of that.
That money and friendship. And I can tell that people enjoy being part of the drama. because yeah, they do feel like they're in an episode of Friends, and you know, Phoebe wants to go to a really expensive spa in Tucson, and you just can't afford it, but you don't know how to say no, and you have to try and tell them why they don't have to do this.
Phoebe would never have wanted to go to the expensive spa.
No,
what
you're
are
right.
you doing?
No,
you've completely
you're right.
misunderstood.
It was when she was grieving for her cat. Let's just rewrite the entirety of Friends. But you realise that you have to break through. Not only you don't have to do this, but you don't have to be the sort of person who's caught up in this actually quite pointless drama.
And I think that, again, with age, though, you realise that you just can't, you know, the stress of it all is not worth the anecdote value or the, you know, the thrill of it. You go, oh no, it's really not. It's really not worth having this in your life. But yeah, there are some things I think it is, you know, it is difficult being an agony aunt. And I think you do tread that line very well of being knowledgeable without being patronising, which I think is a very difficult
one. Yes, and I do try to be honest. So if there's a question I feel I'm not particularly qualified to answer, I will say so, and I'll tell them where else to go for help. So somebody did write in effectively saying, I am probably going to have an arranged marriage. Should I go through with it or not? And I was a bit like, maybe don't ask me about this. But I gave the advice of, you know, go and speak to as many people as you can who know about this kind of thing from your circle of acquaintance, from your parents, and keep an open mind about it and all this sort of thing.
Well, generally, the best advice that I always think, there's a book called Stumbling on Happiness that I read. I don't read a lot of self-help, but I did read this one and I recommend it to everyone. Stumbling on Happiness, and in that, the basic, you know, and it compiles a lot of different research about happiness, and in the end, the most important lesson from that is, if you want to know what something's like, ask someone who's lived through it.
Ask
a lot of people who've lived through it, and then see what they say.
Yeah, well, similarly, somebody just wrote in saying, I'm 45 and I want to have IVF. I'm desperate to have a baby. I know that the odds are really low, but I want to go through with it anyway. How can I prepare myself for this? And I just said, you can't prepare yourself for this. Mm. And I think from the tone of your letter that you're not actually 100% committed to it yet. So try and keep an open mind and go and look for people. And you can easily do this online now. There's so many forums about everything. Go and look for people who have experienced the best case scenario of this and the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And then you'll find out how you feel. Because I can remember... we don't want to discuss childbirth too much, I'm sure, Lucy.
No,
but I can remember when I was I was trying to decide whether to have a home birth with one of my children, and I realised that I was not going to be able to make the decision until I'd read the accounts of lots of disastrous home births.
Well,
you know, I think you have to arm yourself with every extreme of information, every experience, to know exactly how you feel about something.
The problem is, though, then you know, it's easy to then get paralysed by the amount of information that is out there, and every even seemingly tiny decision becomes, you know, again, it's that overcomplicating things, isn't it? It's that, well, it's knowing what are the things that you really need to research.
Yeah, maybe you're not right about that, because you see, I don't get paralysed by information. I find it gives me clarity.
Yeah.
Whereas I do often realise that when people are writing into me at the pool, they just want me to tell them what to do.
And
that's I have to say quite gently, I can't actually really do that. That would be weird, because I'm not living your life.
And also, you might come and find me afterwards if it goes badly wrong. Shall we? Let's play a record, because I want to talk more about this afterwards. And I want to share my woman of achievement with you. But we do need to open it. We've been sitting with the Pims. Look, this is ridiculous.
This is a record.
It's 7:30, guys. We need to get the Pims open. Tapping. There you go. Cheers, everybody at home.
Cheers.
Cheers, girls, ladies, women, females. So let's play a record while we just down that in one.
That is good.
And what are we going to play, Amanda?
We are going to play Viv's Choice today. Yay! Viv, would you like to introduce your record?
This is one of my favourite records by a wonderful, amazing, bonkers woman. It's Bjork and Play Dead.
Oh, nice.
Lucy Porter on FUBAR Radio.
Viv Groskop waiting at the bus stop. No, it's
not, nearly there.
No.
Nearly.
It's got to have some sort of. There's got to be some sort of story in it as well, I think. Viv Groskop got fingered in a bus stop.
Whoa!
Hello. That's better. That's more FUBAR. That's much more FUBAR.
It's too close to the truth.
That's every
it's
Friday
my life
night.
Story.
So, Agony Aunt and advice columnist. What, Agony Aunt, is that still a thing?
I think it is.
Is that what you're called? Is that what you
I think so.
As?
Yeah.
So, Agony Aunt, Viv Groskop, we're going to, because I think you are the best Agony Aunt.
I'm not going to argue with that.
We are going to take a couple of problems that people have written to other agony aunts, and I'm going to compare your advice to the advice that was given by other inferior agony aunts. So,
it's like John Lewis.
Dear Blank, I won't tell you who it is until the end.
Okay.
I keep hearing my parents having sex and I'm not standing for it. I've looked in their bin and there were two empty condom wrappers. What do I do? I've already written them an aggressive letter. I'm 12 and I have heard my parents having sex 5 times, so I talked to them. I stopped hearing them doing it and I was happy until my mum made a joke. My dad was giving her a piggyback, so I said, "What are you doing?" And she laughed, "Don't worry, we're not having sex." Oh. I also came home from school once and was looking for something in my dad's drawer when I found condoms. I then looked in their bin and there were two empty condom wrappers. Then I found a pregnancy test with only one in it when the packet said it contained two. What do I do? I've already written an aggressive letter. Oh, I see. So I read the recap at the top and then I've read the whole thing. So, what would you advise this 12-year-old to do?
Well, before you got to saying they're 12-year-old, my first reaction was, move out! Why are you still living with your parents? This is embarrassing.
Yes.
What an interesting letter.
It's a dilemma.
Very articulate for a 12-year-old.
Almost like someone's made it up.
Yes, almost.
You always worry that.
Well, you see, there's more going on here than meets the eye. There always is. Because it seems to me that possibly the parents are trying to get pregnant, aren't they?
Mm.
To use the technical biological term.
they're trying to get the lady up the
and
stick.
So is this child really worried and upset about hearing their parents having sex, which is absolutely horrible, let's face it. Or are they actually more upset about the fact that they're going to be displaced because there's a sibling coming?
Yes, and also the fact that they're dismissing the concerns of the 12-year-old, saying, you know, a mum laughing, saying, "Oh, don't worry, we're not having sex." That's quite,
yes,
know, that does suggest that they're feeling a bit threatened.
Yes, yeah, so I would suggest if the 12-year-old has another adult in the family that they can go and talk to. I think there's a lot more to be talked about here, and possibly, I don't know, an aunt, an uncle, a family friend. I don't know, an older cousin, somebody they can talk to really talk about how they feel and why. They need to express their frustration that the parents are not listening to them, and possibly get another adult to intervene.
Problem is, if you know, I know this is awful, but if a 12-year-old family member came to me with this dilemma. I don't even know what I'd say. Then.
Well, it needs another adult to go to the parents and say, "Look, for goodness sake, just close the door."
Yes,
or
and address
be more
the
quiet.
Issue. Yeah.
Get some masking tape. You know. Otherwise, the simple advice is earplugs.
Yes. The
But get better parents.
Get better parents.
Get better parents.
See, your advice already better than I can reveal now. This was Colleen Nolan.
Oh.
Who I admire.
Well, she would probably know about this sort of thing.
Well, is no better than she ought to be, is that what you're saying? Don't really. But yes, she says, why not say, "I think it's great you're in love, I just don't want to hear it," then stop thinking about it and get back to your own life.
that's
that doesn't sound like
it's
the
very
no, there was more before that,
right.
but that's the nub of her, that's the final line, which is, get back to your own life. I think in assessing the psychological motivation of this 12-year-old a bit more thoroughly, you have done a better
yes,
job.
Yes, I feel her response is good, but slightly unrealistic.
I think she's probably picturing herself as, and this would be my problem of being an agony aunt, is I would always imagine myself in the position of one of these people. And I think Colleen is picturing herself as the mum. Rather than the child or the father or, you know, yeah.
Yes.
So, yes. Well, good. I think you win. Is that good. A win
yes,
for Viv?
Definitely.
That's a win. Who doesn't yeah, I'll want keep to score. Beat Colleen Nolan? I didn't say that.
Oh, dear. Okay. Right. This is... Oh, this is... Now, a difficult one. So, dear blank... For the past 8 years, I've been living with my mother, stepfather and stepbrother plus four younger siblings. The eldest boy has had to sleep in the same bedroom with me for the past 5 years. I began developing feelings for him after 1 year of staying in the same room. Now I'm in my final year of school, and for me, that sister-brother love is gone and is replaced with what I think is real love. It's become increasingly difficult to hide my attraction as we now spend time together studying too. I can't help but look when he gets changed in the morning, and I'm now ready to share my true feelings. I want to put everything on the line for him, even our family. When people ask what I imagine my future to be, I can't help but think of spending my life with him. I want to know what his feelings are, but I'm scared to open up and get shamed by my family. I honestly don't know if loving my stepbrother romantically is really that bad. I love and desire him with every part of my body and soul. Is this right?
Oh, hashtag awkward.
Hashtag drama for ITV.
Yes. Well, as I was saying earlier, when people write into problem pages, they are very much in love with their part in a drama. And this is what's going on here. The reality of the feelings is almost something that you have to put to one side in these cases. So this poor girl... Who knows what's really going on here?
Is it a girl?
Oh, do we know for certain it's a girl? Oh, okay.
I think we might have been a bit heterosexist there. But,
right. I assumed.
Well, the reply...
Because it was you speaking, Lucy, you see.
Yes. And I have
a girlish tone. I assumed lady.
The reply would suggest that it is a girl.
Right. Hashtag so, even more awkward if it isn't.
Yes. But, yeah, no, I presume the agony person in question has heard more
of this. I think the last thing... Let's assume it's a girl. The last thing she should do is reveal her feelings.
Yes.
Because she risks a massive rejection, which I think is just going to crush her. And... I don't know enough about the family to know who she can trust and whether she might be ridiculed. It sounds as if she's had to keep this very secret. In theory, nothing wrong with being in love with your stepbrother, I think. If there's a there's a distance, or perhaps if you met them in adulthood or something. But, you know, this is another kid that she's sharing a room with, and it's...
It's bordering on incest.
I think if she can talk to a trusted adult, is there a teacher? You know, I think she needs to confide in someone about her feelings.
Well, do you know, you are spot on with the other agony aunt who I respect, which is Mariella. This is a Mariella.
Oh, is it?
It's a Mariella Frostrop in The Guardian. How do you feel about her?
An observer reader.
The Observer.
Oh, yes. I think Mariella's great, actually, and I really like her column. I think it's excellent. She gives good advice.
You and she are on exactly the same page. It's almost word for word what Mariella says there.
Well, you know,
Let's do another.
Her professional secret is out.
The ghostwriter for Mariella. That, you heard it here first. Okay, this one, final one. I'm a student at university, currently in my second year. In contrast to the media depiction of students being a bunch of addicts who spend each night with a different woman, I'm in a stable relationship and have been for the past couple of months. My problem is the woman I'm dating is older than I am. I'm 20 and she's 42. Coincidentally the same age as me. It's not me. The age difference doesn't bother me as we have a lot of similar interests and hobbies. We've been to concerts together and had days out and have a good level of intimacy. But my housemates keep going on at me about the situation. They think she's just some cougar who's using me and that it's not going to go anywhere. I admit I can't see myself marrying her, but should I? We've only been dating a few months and we've kept it pretty laid back. Should I end up with her if I know we're not going to have a future? Should I end it with her if I know we're not going to have a future? Or should we stay together in spite of their judgments?
Very interesting letter. You know, there are certain things I think when I start to respond to somebody that I know I can't say to them directly, but I will in this case. Well, we'll just have to hope they're not listening. But there's an interesting level of immaturity that's being revealed in this letter, with lots of the contradictions of the thing about the intimacy. That's quite odd. What does that mean?
Yes, a good level of intimacy.
A good level of intimacy. What does that mean? And the thing about, of course, I don't want to marry her, or do I? There's a certain level of immaturity there that's interesting, which makes me think that really this person wants to have the courage of their own convictions, but they don't quite have it. So my
they say the age difference doesn't bother me, but
yes, but why are you writing this letter then?
Yeah.
So I would say, don't listen to your friends, listen to yourself. You know, he's obviously happy with this woman, with whatever relationship they're having, which is slightly, I don't know if he's just imagined it all, actually.
Yeah, it does sound, well, the reply, now this was Graham Norton.
Oh, I love Graham Norton.
And again, excellent advice. I understand that you're young, but even at your age, you must know that 2 months is not a very long time.
Well, that's code for you're immature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. I love the fact we've got agony aunt code.
Mm.
There we go. That's you are just a tiny child.
I'm so intrigued by the certain level of intimacy.
A certain
I want
level
to be
intimacy.
Single
oh, no,
again.
No, it's a good level.
A good
of
level of intimacy.
Do you think you have a good level of intimacy?
I'd love to say that on a date. Can we have a good level of intimacy
level
this
of
evening?
Intimacy. That's what I'm looking for. Here's a final one. I've been going around with a boy for... I said that one was the last one. It's not. I've been going around with a boy for some time, and just lately we have started making love in a very passionate way.
Oh, good
I
level
mentioned
of intimacy.
This to a friend of mine, and she was very shocked. I cannot truthfully say I'm ashamed of my behaviour, but I must admit that occasionally I feel guilty. Is lovemaking of this sort wrong, and if so, what shall I do? Incidentally, I'm only 17, but I've always mixed with a crowd considerably older than myself, from Bunny.
It sounds like a Dear Deirdre, this one. What lovemaking of what sort? I didn't get that.
I should tell you what this letter is. It's from Sarah Hope's problem page from the Home Notes magazine in 1947.
Oh,
so
bless.
The reply has to be, you're living in 1947. You are
yes.
a woman
oh.
out of time.
Yes, as I was thinking, well, you know, what are you doing that's so wrong?
Yes.
As long as...
We've started making love in a very passionate way.
Yeah. Oh.
I know.
I think that's code for... a good level of intimacy.
I think it is. We've come out of, whatever we can say about tonight, we have come out with so many euphemisms for the penetrative act. So just to close our agony aunt section, I wanted to share with you my great woman of the week. And every week I try and gear this towards the interests or activities of my guest. And so today I have picked for you the newly... appointed agony aunt of the Paul Viv Groskop. I have chosen Claire Bernice Rayner, OBE,
aww.
Née Chetwynd, who was born on the 22nd of January 1931 and sadly died on the 11th of October 2010. The English nurse, journalist, broadcaster and novelist, best known for her role for many years as an agony aunt. And I could not love anyone more than I love Claire Rayner. I adore her. She was born in London. Her father was a tailor, her mother was a housewife, and she had a terrible childhood. Her childhood was marred by physical and mental cruelty at the hands of her parents. After the family emigrated to Canada in 1945, she was placed in a psychiatric hospital by her parents and treated for 15 months for a thyroid defect. So she had this horrible sort of loveless childhood. But then she returned to the UK in 1951, training as a nurse at the Royal Northern Hospital in Guy's Hospital. She intended to become a doctor while training as a nurse. However, she met the actor Desmond Rayner, who she married in 1957, and then she went on to be a midwife and a nursing sister. And then she started writing to the Nursing Times and the Daily Telegraph all about nursing and about the NHS. And gradually, her writing kind of overtook her nursing, and she wrote for Woman's Own. And she was sort of in the era of Marge Proops and the sort of first great British agony aunts. And her frank advice in the teenage girls' magazine Petticoat caused controversy. In 1972, she was accused of encouraging masturbation and promiscuity in prepubescent girls. The BBC asked her to be the first person on British pre-watershed television to demonstrate how to put on a condom. I remember that being a huge thing. Mm. And she was one of the first people used by advertisers to promote sanitary towels. She then started an agony column in The Sun, left to join the Sunday Mirror, and then she was on TVAM in the 80s and 90s, which is kind of where I really remember. And that was a time when I felt I had a lot of problems, and Claire Rayner seemed to me to be a lovely, warm problem solver. And she, throughout her life, was an incredible sort of political activist. She supported so many charities. She was campaigned for prisoners' rights. She was the vice president, in fact, vice president and president of the British Humanist Association. And just a lovely woman. She met her husband, Des, in 1957. They had three children together, one of whom, of course, we know, the writer and food critic, Jay Rayner, and Adam and Amanda. And then she died in 1971.
1971?
She died at 71, sorry, in 2002. Sorry, thank you for putting me up on that. She died at the age of 71 in 2002. She told relatives that she wanted her last words to be, "Tell David Cameron that if he screws up my beloved NHS, I'll come back and bloody haunt him."
Well, she's going to be back soon,
isn't she? I suspect that she's on her way.
Wow.
We can only hope. But what an amazing woman
she
really was.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that, Lucy.
I thought I was really going to cry. I promised crying, but...
Well, I have to say, I'm a huge, huge fan as well. And I also discovered her through TVAM. I know Jay Rayner a little bit because he is my colleague at The Observer. I think he's a great writer and a great performer as well, actually. And I know he's sort of been a great one for flying the flag for his mum's memory, but I had no idea that she'd had such a traumatic childhood.
I know. Well, I haven't read.
I didn't know that.
I'm going to get, and I will then pass on to you. How did I get here from there? Her autobiography.
I'd love to read that.
I'm on the internet getting that tonight.
And yeah, what an extraordinary woman and an amazing role model for someone being maternal in the public eye.
Yes,
which is something we don't really see now.
That's very true. Just absolutely.
Where has that gone? You know, she was like a real life Hattie Jakes of Carry On Matron, wasn't she? But in a good way.
And all that, you know, you remember the spitting image puppet of her, which was always, cheer up, lovey, you know, and it was, but yeah, she was a properly comforting, reassuring. And I mean, it is about, older women on television have definitely become less visible. And even, the one role that you would think that older women could play, which is being mumsy and reassuring, even that does seem to have disappeared. And older women are kind of meant to be sexy and alluring and... the idea of the wise matriarch is kind of disappearing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I remember when I was watching the election coverage, I was evaluating it for Woman's Hour for the next day, and I was just watching the television and thinking, where are the elderly stateswomen?
Yes.
There aren't any.
Of broadcasting or of
broadcasting
politics. Really,
Or even a statistician. Yeah. Would have done.
Yeah.
A 70-year-old woman who loves maths.
Yes.
or a Claire Rayner figure, someone who cares and who knows about the NHS and who's lived through it all and done it all and seen it all.
Yeah.
Well, we don't see that.
No, it's true. Well, and actually, yes, someone with... The other thing that we have, of course, lost is the people changing careers... From it's all career politicians, career broadcasters now.
She had this incredible wealth of experience that she could draw on. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Shall we raise a PIMS?
We shall.
Let's raise a PIMS and have a song, shall we? Cheers, Claire
Rayner.
Come back and haunt David Cameron. So what song shall we have to celebrate? No, it's going to be an awful
Peaches song. One of her favourites, actually.
Yes. Is it Love At It?
It's Love At It. I think this is definitely on her playlist.
I think Claire would have loved it.
She would have loved it.
This is for you, Claire. Love At It. I just can't stop saying Love At It. Which might be my new name for you, Viv Groskop. How about that?
Don't tell everyone about that secret moment that we shared, Lucy Porter.
Love At It. It's Love At It, Groskop. On FUBAR Radio. There you go. That's much. It's
that
easier.
That's so beautiful.
Because Love At It, I could rhyme a lot of things with that. So
you could.
Listening to the hits with Love At It on FUBAR. Anyway, we'll workshop it. It's fine. So Love At It. Let's talk. Since it's flown by, and we have to go. So we've got to talk about what you're doing, your life, your work, as well as being Britain's finest agony aunt, joint with Mariella Frostrop and Graham Norton. Above Colleen Rooney. No, not Colleen Rooney, Colleen Nolan. But your comedy career as a world-class comedian continues apace.
Yes, world-class comedy.
Your world-class comedy career is going very well.
At the moment, I'm crazily rehearsing researching and rehearsing at my Edinburgh show, which is called Say Sorry to the Lady, which is what I spend most of my life saying because my children children have very loud voices on public transport and say what they think of passers-by.
And because you hang out with me sometimes.
Yes,
and I quite often say inappropriate
things. Say
sorry to the
lady.
Say sorry to the audience.
And I'm doing that at the Stand.
Which is the finest comedy club in Edinburgh, as we've discussed in many times. So 8:20 p.m. for the Edinburgh Festival, which is basically the whole of August.
Yeah, from this, my previews on the 5th of August, the show starts on the 7th of August through to the 30th. And before then, I'm doing loads of previews all over the place, including Brighton Fringe this weekend. But also, my secret weapon is the WI.
So
I've been doing,
lots
lots of previews at the WI, because it's always really difficult for new comedians to rehearse their Edinburgh material, because there are loads of previews that are free and not particularly well attended in London. People, start attending previews. Please do that.
I know, we love it when you do that. I'm not even doing a show this year, but I'm going to see lots and lots of previews.
Yeah, it's good to see, to support people, but it's hard to get audience out for Work in Progress.
If anyone wants to come and see, I'm seeing Angela Barnes at the Harrow Arts Centre.
She's next week's guest.
Oh, she's next week's guest.
Yeah.
We can talk
July
to her about
the 4th.
That.
Okay, very good. I'll
but
try
and
come to that.
So,
yeah,
the WI.
So, I thought, you know, who has access to a room of 50, 60 people who might like to hear some comedy? And it's the WI.
Genius. So, you are an absolute genius at this kind of thing.
I don't know if the WI thinks that at the moment. So I was with Shoreditch Sisters last night.
I'd imagine that is a young and trendy WI.
Well, it's very mixed, actually. Mm. They are young and trendy, and they're really into their crafting. They've got... I think they've got a blanket in the British Museum or something like
For,
that.
For any listeners who aren't aware, Shoreditch is an area of London that has an extraordinarily high wanker per capita level.
Yes,
even by London
not
standards.
In the WI, obviously.
But obviously not at the WI, but it's an interesting part of London.
Yeah, so they're based in the Bethnal Green Working Men's Club.
Which is a lovely,
lovely venue. So I went and did a bit of my preview yesterday for them, which was really fun. And then afterwards it was the raffle.
That's great.
And somebody won a canine crochet kit, which they were very pleased with.
Very good. I mean, it's a great untapped resource generally. I mean, I might try and bill in on your success and do... Because I've got a couple of things I've always thought, I'd like to talk about that.
You should.
Rather than try and do a comedy show about it, I'd like to do a talk that's lightly humorous.
They have talks every month. Indeed, when I finished last night, someone came on and said, thanks very much, Viv. Next time, it's the history of the blanket.
Yes. I'd imagine you were a bit of a break from the crafting. There's a lot of... Well, my mum used to be in the WI and it was a lot of flower arranging. And I think they are trying to change their... My favourite ever WI thing was that story about the WI branch where they'd invited a man along to talk about pirates and they all dressed up as comedy pirates and it turns out he'd actually been kidnapped by Somali pirates and had a terrible, gruelling ordeal. If you've never seen that, do look online for WI pirates. It is hilarious. But that's a wonderful... So you've got... If people want to come and see you, they can see you at WIs around the place.
Yes, they can.
Various other venues. And vivgroskop.com. Why do I find it hard to say your name?
Everyone does. Even John Humphrey.
Lovatits.com.
Yeah, lovatits.com.
Vivgroskop. It's the Pims, isn't it? Vivgroskop.com. And it's been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It's
on
been great.
The show. And if anyone wants to get in touch, at Fubar Radio, at Luna Bimberton, at Viv Groskop on Twitter. And we will see you next week. I'm actually here next week. Awesome.
You are.
Brilliant. And a huge thank you to producer Amanda.
It's a pleasure as always.
And we're going to play out with...
Don't Call Me Baby, Voice of the Beehive.
Oh, God, I saw them at the Underworld in Camden.
Did you really?
Yes.
Here we go.